Good morning. My name is Darren Murphy. Welcome to the Computershare half-year results briefing for financial year 2008. I'd like to introduce Stuart Crosby, our Chief Executive Officer, and Tom Honan, our Chief Financial Officer, who will be presenting this morning. We'll kick it off with Stuart providing a summary of the results. We'll follow that with Tom going into more depth around the numbers. And Stuart will conclude the presentation with an update regarding strategy and a review from around the globe. For those wanting to put a question forward, please press star 1. If you'd like to leave that queue to cancel, please hit star 2. We expect the briefing to last around 1 hour. I'd like to introduce Stuart Crosby.
Thank you, Darren, and good morning, everyone. Today, of course, this is by no means the most important announcement being made in Australia. There was a very important one in Canberra this morning. While Computershare is very much a global company, as far as its business is concerned, its corporate personality is distinctly Australian, and I think today is a good day to be an Australian. Moving to our results announcement, and what Tom and I will do is work through the PowerPoint presentation that was posted on the internet this morning and released to ASX. We have, I believe, a really good story for you today about the first half of financial year 2008. Our management earnings per share for the first 6 months were up 53%. Net profit after outside equity interest was up nearly 50%. Free cash flows are up nearly 45%. And again, the thing that's driven that is a higher growth in revenue, up nearly 15%, as against costs, which in constant dollar terms have pretty well straight lined. Our dividend, we have increased again in step with the recent pattern of increases, and importantly, we're in a position to return to dividend franking, and this dividend will be 20% franked. We have historically shown a slide next which shows some of the Thomson corporate action numbers, which at the last minute, honestly, we took out because we've never thought it was particularly helpful in understanding what drives our business. We've talked before about how size of corporate actions is completely uncorrelated to their financial value to us. So as I say, we took that out. We have included a series of charts on global interest rate levels, which are there for noting, and I won't editorialise on, but we will look forward to questions on that when the Q&A time comes. So briefly, to round out the introduction, what I want to do is recapitulate what we see as our strengths, which is a high level of recurring income, a high level of global diversification, our proven capacity to both deliver technology and innovate in relation to technology and to acquire and integrate businesses. Importantly, in the current environment, our balance sheet and our cash flow situation are real assets, and we'll talk about that again later. And I guess the unique point of Computershare is that because we have businesses that can work together in a range of different places, our capacity to service global transactions is without any sort of peer in the world. So that rounds out what I wanted to say before handing over to Tom to go through some of the more numerical and detailed issues. But I should reiterate what's in our release about our expectations going forward for the rest of this year, which is that in the light of the half-year results and having done some careful analysis, we are lifting our guidance for full-year earnings, management earnings per share growth from 30% to 40%. That's really the quick overview that I wanted to give. I'll hand over now to Tom Honan, our Chief Financial Officer. Tom.
Thank you, Stuart, and welcome to all on the line. A special hello to all of those Computershare staff around the world who've assisted in either driving or producing this result. We won't be long, so you can all get back to work. I'd like to start on page 10, which commences with a summary of our financial performance. You'll see total revenue of $788 million, which, as Stuart said earlier, was up around 14% on the prior corresponding period. Management EBITDA of $257 million and earnings per share expressed in management adjusted terms of $0.2736 per share. Stuart talked about 14% revenue growth and 5% operating cost growth, driving an EBITDA result of 36%. Efficiencies below the EBITDA line drive an NPAT result 46% higher than last year, and the buyback and other events drive an increase beyond that to a 53% growth in earnings per share. Next page, the last couple of results, we've talked about major drivers behind our corporate financial performance. Some of the items on this list are different to the last period, but all are still valid. It's fair to say, as we'll go through the results, that the company's not firing on all cylinders, but it is still an excellent result. It shows the portfolio effect of some businesses delivering, over-delivering and compensating for those businesses that are not quite performing to the level that they were a year ago. The next page, page 12, shows our earnings per share from a rolling 12-month perspective, the performance of that. Earnings per share is the company's target measure. And if you look at this, we show 3 years of performance from, as I said, a rolling 12-month perspective. The first of those years, 24% growth. The second of those, 78% growth. And the most recent, which is 49% from a rolling 12-month perspective. That shows a compound annual growth rate of 49% over the past 3 years. Page 13. In 2005, we communicated our internal targets to the market, and that internal target was 20% growth in earnings. And since then, we've obviously been well in excess of that target, in fact, closer to 50% compound annual growth rate rather than 20%. Page 14, just want to talk about a few points here. The first one of those is one I've already spoken about, which is the comparison to the first half of last year of 53% growth. Growing from 17.8 cents a share to 27.3. The second point is that 27.3 is 45% on top of the second half of 07, so the most recent half. And those two increases, 53% and 45%, have come off a high base. For example, the first half of 07, the prior corresponding period, was up 102% on the first half of 06. So if you like, we've delivered 102% from the first half of 06 to the first half of 07, and then another 53% to the first half of 08. Page 15 shows where the growth in net profit has come from. The first point I'd make is that all regions have contributed to that growth, and I'll talk about some of that detail later. But you can see Asia Pacific delivering $34 million, Europe, Middle East and Africa delivering almost $17 million, and North America delivering almost $18 million. There is a higher interest number of $4.8 million, which is obviously driven by the buyback as much as anything, and that's been offset by the number of shares reduction, which shows, as I said before, the 7% difference between NPAT growth and earnings per share growth. $13.2 million is unfortunately an unhappy consequence of making more money. We need to pay more tax. Unhappy for most of us anyway. All of that delivering a 46% increase in NPAT from $107 million to almost $156 million. The next page starts a section on operating cash flows. Anyone that knows me knows that I love the cash flow pages. In the days of IFRS and AIFRS and other accounting acronyms, cash generation is especially pleasing. The $206 million of operating cash flow is up 50% on the prior corresponding period. You'll see some CapEx numbers there in yellow, and I'll talk about that later. Free cash flows on page 17, and what this shows is that the four-year compound annual growth rate of 71% in cash flows, in free cash flows, which we define as operating cash flows less capex. Page 18, I'll talk about EBITDA margin later, but it's an area that Stuart has spent a lot of time on, and we can see that it's definitely paying off through revenue quality, and also through operating cost efficiency, and also tie in through some of the technology cost slides that we display later on in the presentation. But you can see that as I said, revenue growing 14% from 694 to 788, the blue columns, and the red line of EBITDA growing 36% from 188 to 257 million. You can really see the leverage of that margin improvement. The next page, 19, and if I focus on the first half, which is the left section of that page, we can really see the growth in revenue, but more importantly, the growth in margin, growing at a much higher rate than the growth in revenue. And page 20 focuses on that margin, whereas not that long ago that we were struggling around the 20% level of margin. We've driven that up into the high 20s last year and into the low 30s this year. As I said before, this is about cost control, but it's also about the quality of revenue. And as I said, something that Stuart has focused on and continues that focus, and you'll see some references later on in his presentation about revenue quality. Page 21 shows a revenue breakdown, and I'm sure the highlights to most people will be two lines, the register maintenance growing at 16% and the corporate actions growing at 42% across the 12 months. I also want to focus on two other numbers, which are fund services and employee share plans. Fund services is down 44%, and employee share plan is only up 1%. To me, that shows that our portfolio of businesses can support some where the growth is not as significant as others. Fund services coming off an extremely good first half of 07. They're not losing market share. It's just that the number of transactions that occurred in the first half of 07 wasn't repeated in the first half of 08, and so therefore the revenue was down. That plays a big part in what we'll see later on in terms of the North American revenue numbers. But as I said, the great thing is it was more than offset by growth in the other parts of our business. Communication services, 19%. Technology and other revenues, 34%. Stakeholder relationships, 17%. Register maintenance, 16%. And corporate actions, obviously the highlight, 42%. I'll talk later on the next slide, actually, on the margin income, but you'll see there in the note they've grown from $84 million to $123 million during the 12-month period. The next page, 22, displays that and also displays the average interest rates in each of those three key countries. We earn margin income in other countries apart from those three, but the vast majority is in those three countries. Obviously, the biggest impact here is the average balance size, which continues to grow at a much higher rate than our revenue base. Next page, 23, shows our revenue and EBITDA breakdown. And really what we're seeing here is a change in the past 12 months from North America to Asia Pacific. So North America, a slight slowdown in revenue and in EBITDA terms haven't been able to keep pace with the rest of the world. I look in terms of the growth rates in each of these regions. So North America has grown 16% versus last year's first half. Ordinarily, we'd be very pleased with that growth, but it's only when you compare it to the other two regions that you see that they've dropped from 58% of our EBITDA to 50% of our EBITDA. Europe, Middle East and Africa has grown 42%, therefore relatively keeping pace. But Asia Pacific has grown 87% in the half and has grown from 21% of the EBITDA of corporation to 28%, a much higher rate than has been recently. Page 24 shows the operating costs, a very pleasing result when you consider that first half of 07 at $367 million has grown to $395 million in the first half of 08. But in fact, that's a flat result in constant dollars. It really shows the impact of a lot of hard work in efficiency improvements and in technology advances. That leads well into the next page, showing that we continue to grow our technology costs, but keeping them relatively flat in terms of as a percentage of sales revenues, and as I said, have driven many of the efficiency improvements. It's particularly pleasing when we see the next page on page 26, that development costs are now 40% of the total, and remember that we continue to expense all of those costs. It's pleasing that as the total pie increases in terms of the technology costs, growing from $70 million last half, $61 million the prior corresponding period, up to $77 million, the percentage of development spend has increased over that time. Now I turn to the balance sheet. The biggest impact in the past 12 months has been raising debt to buy back shares. There's been an impact of a 55% increase in non-current liabilities. I'll talk about that a little bit later to fund the buyback. And the reduction in equity is more than represented by the buyback of almost $300 million in terms of US dollar terms. Key financial ratios on page 28, and even after the increase in debt, still well within the tolerance levels of the company, net financial indebtedness to EBITDA of still under 1.5 times. I've said a number of times to the board would be comfortable in the 2.5 to 3 times range, and that provides us with a lot of capacity to fund acquisitions and other things, and Stuart will talk about that a little bit later. Another one I'll just quickly focus on is the EBITDA interest coverage, the relevant financial ratio, and even though we've increased the debt, we've increased the EBITDA to a greater or a relatively same extent, so the EBITDA interest coverage has changed from 11.9 last year to 12.2 this year, virtually no change at all. Just very quickly on the Computershare borrowings, the average tenor of those is 4 years, and as I said, the net debt to management EBITDA, which is the key measure that we use and our financiers use, we're still in a very comfortable position. Page 30 is a new page that we decided to add, and it was really to give an explanation on a debt facility maturity profile. Just spend a few moments on this page. You can see that less than 20% of our debt matures in the next 3 years. The majority of the debt was refinanced in October 2007, probably surprisingly to some of us, that was at rates better than those rates that we achieved 3 years earlier. We obviously could have achieved them if we'd done it earlier when the market was slightly better. We could have done better, but it's not often easy to pick the bottom or the top of the market. We didn't quite pick the bottom of the market, but we feel very comfortable that we've secured long-term debt facilities for the company, as I said, of almost $1 billion, with less than 20% coming due, maturing in the next 3 years, and recognising also that that $160 million in FY09 that comes due is well less than 6 months free cash flow. I said, I'll turn to page 31, and I said earlier on that I would come back to the CapEx number, 18.8, slightly higher than $17.9 million last half, a fair way higher than the prior corresponding period of 7.8. The biggest increase in that is occupancy capex, and I'll just say a couple of things about that. One is that it's always a lumpy number, the occupancy capex. We almost completed the North American property rationalisation, and so some of it has come from that. The other thing I'd say is that it's driven also by acquisitions. So if we acquire a business that we can consolidate into our existing facilities, the capex number tends to be low because we're just moving people into our existing offices. But sometimes we need to take a new office and bring it up to what I'd say is the Computershare standard. The Computershare standard is certainly not A-plus grade. It's probably B grade in terms of office facilities, but some small businesses that we acquire are well lower than that, and so we need to bring them up to that standard, and that's driven about half of that that occupancy increase. We see that still continuing in the sort of low, maybe mid-30s into the future, relatively close to the depreciation number going forward. Next, page 32, very pleased with the day sales outstanding. It's based on a lot of hard work, and again, a representation of the quality of the revenue and the quality of the client relationships is that we can drive that number lower. One of our directors joked to me yesterday about how long I could spend on this slide. We're very proud of this result in the finance team and in the client team, and we'll continue to drive that number even lower. Page 33, with profit increases, not surprising that the return on invested capital gets up close to 20%, but to me one of the highlights is the next page on 34, when you combine the profit increases with the number of shares outstanding reduction, we're getting very close to a 40% return on equity, which is a wonderful place to be as the CFO of a company. Our Australian shareholders will be very pleased that we've reintroduced franking. It's not a large percentage, but it's a percentage that we believe we can continue for the immediate future. Dividends increased from 8 and 9 cents in the past two halves to 10 cents in this half, as I said, the franking percentage of 20%. Next page just shows the ordinary share buyback, 45 million shares, which was completed during the past half. And really just a few comments on page 37. Just to summarise, very strong earnings per share growth of 53%, free cash flow after CapEx up 44%, record revenues, an extremely strong balance sheet, especially when you consider that debt maturity that I took you through earlier, return on equity getting close to 40%, dividends up to 10 cents with a 20% franking. You can understand why I'm very pleased to hand over to Stuart.
And I'm very pleased to have heard you go through all of that, Tom. What I want to do before we move to Q&A is just run through what we are trying to do at a strategic level and do a few around the grounds things which I've tried not to spend too much time on. Strategically, this slide 40 in the pack, is the same one that we've put up the last few presentations. We are not strategic butterflies. We have a long-term view of what we want to do with our business, and we will continue to try and execute on that. The points are basically to continue to work on the cost line through benchmarking, through applying technology, but vitally by measuring what we do and being in a position to assess the financial impact. Secondly, we continue to work on the revenue line, work on the way we deal with our clients and how to get proper financial recognition for the quality of the services we provide and the value we add. And thirdly, to look for acquisition and other opportunities to enhance returns. I guess the M&A question is where the next slide goes. We had a couple of quiet M&A years, it's no secret. Part of that, I guess, was that we were fairly busy bedding down the Equiserve acquisition, but a part of it was too that valuations in the market got to a difficult place, and while it was at times difficult to do, we pretty well retained our capacity to not do deals at prices that didn't stack up. We kept our financial discipline, and so we didn't do huge deals over the last couple of years. Obviously, we now have a different environment where the biggest competitor in those deals, the financial sponsor world, is having to deal with different funding structures and different funding prices, and where we're seeing opportunities emerge at much more sensible valuations. So in financial year 08 to date, we've already announced north of $300 million in transactions, which is a material increase on, as I say, the prior 2 years. I've listed a few of the key ones there. There are also a couple of smaller ones mopping up effectively the distribution network for our IML wireless voting system. But DataCare is a provider of corporate governance software and bolted onto our world records business. UMB was a small regional US transfer agency business, again a straight bolt-on opportunity. Administar is interesting and worth thinking about a bit as people think about our exposure to market cycles. Administar is a provider of bankruptcy and class action administration services, and you'd not be surprised to know that the revenue pipeline there looks reasonably promising at the moment. RSS is a nice little business that provides software to help insiders manage programmed trading that takes advantage of regulatory safe harbours against accusations of insider dealing. BEM is the corporate actions bank in Germany, the acquisition of which we announced late last year, and which takeover is very close to the end of its process now. And QMT we announced a week or so ago, which is an acquisition that bolts on to our Australian print and mail business, communications business rather, Computershare Communication Services. I guess the short version, and referring back to what Tom was saying, is that we are in a good financial position now to continue to look at opportunities. We have good cash flows, we have a strong balance sheet, we have very good capacity to fund acquisitions in an environment where we see some really interesting opportunities emerging, and that's clearly a priority for us. The next slide deals with quality differentiation, something I mentioned at our investor briefing last year, where we have a very good opportunity at our annual general meeting last year it was, where we see real opportunities to take what we are achieving in terms of quality improvements in our service and get financial recognition for them. We've been working diligently for a number of years in this area, and we're now seeing real appetite from issuers and employers for enhanced service offerings and the potential to get continued revenue enhancements from that. As well, and they really fit very closely together, the move to electronic shareholder communications is something that we've invested a lot on in over the last few years, and where we are really in a thought leadership position. We've been very prominent in the SEC debates on the notice and access regime in the US. We've been able to take to our Australian and UK clients products that let them take full advantage of the changes to the shareholder communications regimes there, and I'll talk a little bit around the globe on that later in this slide. It's also important to recognise the role of the Georgeson consulting and proxy solicitation offerings in this context. Obviously, they are more suited to non-routine shareholder communications than to shareholder communications. We are changing the shape of the Georgeson business to meet the challenges of the new market. There has been some, honestly, fairly stupid commentary in the Australian, in the gossipy columns in the Australian financial press about some of this, so I thought I would just diverge briefly and talk about that. When we acquired Cook Georgeson, it came with some terrific people, people like Bill Crane, David Drake, Kellen Carson, who continue to be with us in very senior roles. It also came with some quite high maintenance individuals who had no real understanding of the profitability of the businesses that they were working in. We have managed over the last little while to shed some of those people, and we are now in a position where that business, and if you look at the revenue numbers from Tom's revenue breakup slide, is performing better than it ever has, where it's now run by people who actually understand running businesses, and we are in great shape, having moved on some of the prima donnas that we inherited from the acquisition. We're looking to build that team further, and it is a business that excites us. It is frustrating to see some of the old guard trying to blacken our name. In the press, I will say no more about that. I have included in the next slide a quick around the grounds on where we are. A lot of analysts I know have been interested in how proxy and access was going to work out for us. We're now through the first season, and we've seen our revenue aspirations exceeded in that area, and we think that we have positioned ourselves very well to take full financial benefit, and that clearly notice and access will be a net plus for us rather than a net negative financially. In Australia, it's interesting to note that only 10% of shareholders who have been offered have elected to receive a hard copy of annual reports, so we're having very strong uptake of some of our report hosting and online communication services wrapped around that. Similarly, in the UK, in the second year of quite similar but not identical regime, we're seeing strong uptake of our product offerings around that. As we say, we really created a market leadership position in this space, and we see it as being a very, very positive thing for us, both in direct revenue and in the recognition we get from our clients as people who can navigate them through a changed environment. Moving on to the around the grounds, I've included these slides. I won't actually drill down on much of it. In particular, Tom mentioned the fund services business in the US and the fact that there aren't the mega transactions in that space that we're seeing a year ago. Like Tom, I find it very gratifying that our portfolio of businesses protect us and let us take the benefit of those businesses in the good years, but you know, not have them handicap us when things when the lumps are down rather than up, which is where they are in that space at the moment. I also have to say that there's no direct correlation between the sort of transactions that drive activity in that space and overall levels of corporate activity. Similarly, the class action and bankruptcy administration business has an encouraging pipeline. Canada continues to be the quiet achiever in the computer share world, and is continuing quietly to be performed very, very satisfactorily. EMEA, in the capable hands of Mr. Morris, is also doing very, very well. Russia, consolidation in Russia has been good for us, and one of the big lumps in reported profit actually came from consolidating some businesses that we previously equity accounted. The VEM acquisition in Germany is nearly completed, and that's gone all very satisfactorily. Obviously, that business will be affected to some extent by market activities, but the principal reason we bought it was for the way it plugged in with our other business, and we see those opportunities being able to be executed on exactly as we envisioned them. Ireland is interesting. I spent some time there recently, and especially in the ETF space, there is very good growth there in a market that we had been looking at as pretty mature. And the IML wireless voting business, which has been, again, a terrific asset for us, and a number of you will have seen at our general meetings and investor briefings or at major company AGMs within Australia. We are changing the business model there, whereas they relied on third-party distributors. We're now in the process of bringing a lot of that back in-house, often by acquiring reasonably small businesses that provide that service. The Asia-Pacific region, Hong Kong IPOs, has obviously been a standout for us. We were expecting them to drop off in as a result of some regulatory changes within China, and that hasn't happened. Obviously, we continue to monitor market conditions there, but that has been very good for us. Our Beijing office is now established, and we're looking to migrate some of our quick-growing Chinese plans opportunities there. I can't not mention the Reliance Power IPO in India, where we processed over 6 million applications in 8 days, which is the largest in terms of applications IPO ever. Australia and New Zealand are also good stories with very strong performance under capable management in the hands of Mark Davis. So looking forward, what do we see? We see that we have a strong operational financial platform for continued growth. We've got a good balance sheet, we've got good revenues and cash flows, we understand the margins in our business better than we ever had, and so we're very well positioned to take on whatever challenges and opportunities the environment throws at us. Strategically, we are focused on the same things we always have been: costs, revenues and growth, inorganic growth. Specifically, we think there are going to be some good M&A opportunities over the next little while, and we're looking forward to being able to work on them. We have a strong focus on quality and getting financial recognition for quality differentiated offerings, and the shareholder communication space has been a really good one for us over the last year or so, as we see return on the investment we've made over the last few years in product competence and industry expertise in that area. Lastly, as I said earlier, we are upgrading our outlook for financial year 08 and expect approximately 40% management earnings per share growth over the previous year. At that point, I think I hand back to Darren, who administers the Q&A process, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Okay, we are ready to take the first question, Paul.
Thank you, gentlemen. This question comes from John Haggerty from ABN AMRO. Go ahead, John.
Thanks very much, and congratulations on the result, guys. Just two questions from me. Firstly, on the sustainability of corporate action revenues into FY09. I know you've touched on this a bit, but it is interesting you've taken out the slides from Thompson. Surely we can expect that corporate action revenue to sort of fall a little bit next year, or at least be quite a bit weaker. Could you give us some sort of thoughts on that?
John, the short answer is that, as we've continued to say, the dollar value of corporate actions is not a meaningful estimate of revenues. We're seeing things like the return to rights issues in the UK, where we've seen a few recently, which are pretty financially reasonable for us. So while it may be that there are and we're also seeing at the top end some big M&A transactions continuing, the truth is that it's impossible for us, and therefore I suspect for you and your colleagues, to model the financial impacts of global M&A cycles. The impacts are really local. The best example always is IPOs, where you can have a huge IPO in the US and we make $10,000 out of it. You can have a medium-sized IPO in Hong Kong and we make many, many multiples of that. It really depends where the action is, how it mechanically works. You know, in M&A deals, scrip deals are better for us than cash deals generally, but that's not always the case. The short answer to your question is, I don't know. I think it would be rash to predict one way or the other, and in that way I'm not jealous of analysts who are trying to come up with financial models for our revenue line. We're very comfortable in making our forecast that we have a degree of visibility of what's in our pipeline between now and the end of the financial year, but as you look into 2009, I'm not going to say, I really just can't answer your question. I think Tom has something to add as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about the Thompson slide, John. It wasn't an accident that was removed. The number of reports that we read that assess the continued profitability of our company based on Thompson statistics started to concern us, and it's because, as Stuart said, the sheer value of the deal, the sheer number of the deals, bears little or no relationship to our profitability, and so we thought it was better that we actually didn't put that slide in our pack, because we thought it could potentially be misleading for people to use, even though a lot of your peers continue to use those sorts of materials in their research notes.
The only other thing I'd say for that slide, in fact, the last data was end FY07, and the line actually trended up. We haven't taken it out because it had a cliff at the end of it. We took it out because we thought it just really didn't help understand we are as a business.
Thanks very much. Long answer, which, still leaves me none the wiser, really. But second question, you've actually added another slide on margin income analysis, which I think is very helpful. Could you just explain that a little bit more? What sort of dollar values you're given there? Is that sort of a revenue line or a sort of profit for tax line? And also, could you explain why average balances suddenly ticked up and where we can expect those to go?
Okay, so the first point is that that's a revenue line. It's not a profit, it's margin income revenue that we earn. The second thing I'd say about it is that over the past 4 years, we've continued to try and get the balances earlier and for longer from our clients. And what you see here is the result of some of that work. And so the balance is going from $6.5 billion and in earlier periods, much less than that, up to $8.7 in the last half. And that's been a concerted effort to increase those balances. Some of it has come from corporate actions, obviously, but most of it's come from a general increase. As to projections for client balances, John, the standard answer I give to all questions about projections is that we project our earnings per share numbers, and that's all we project.
Okay, thanks very much.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Chris Williams from UBS. Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks very much. I've just got a couple of questions. A follow-on in relation to the margin income question, and I'm referring specifically to slide 61 later in the pack in the appendices. Can you just tell us a little bit about the downside protection that's quite evident in that line in terms of your exposures, a little bit about the nature of those hedges and also the duration, more particularly about the hedges that you've got in place?
Generally, the first thing I'd say is that this is in relationship to the... So these numbers that you see on slide 61, Chris, refer to our core balances, which is not all of the $8.7 billion. Obviously, there's some of the $8.7 billion that is not exposed to any interest rate moves, so it doesn't cover those. And it also doesn't cover the what I call the non-core balances that tend to be there for a very short period of time. The core balances that we have, though, the protection is generally, in general terms, not 100% of the time, generally around floors, and those floors have been purchased in the last 12 months. And generally, they had a five-year duration. So you'd think that in average terms left, we've got around 4 years left of those floors. The expense treatment of those floors is basically that you expense roughly a fifth of it in each year. So we've taken a fifth of the expense into the current year's expense line. The total cost of those is in the $1 million level, so it's between $5 and $10 million that we've spent on those floors.
So it's fair to assume then that the main point of leverage now is to balances and mix of balances.
Yeah, correct.
Okay. I've got a second question too, please. Just wanted to understand a little bit, and you drew out the strength in the register maintenance revenue line. Can you give us a sense of the incremental growth that you've got there, perhaps between acquired growth, so UMB, for example, price improvements and underlying shareholder accounts and so on? Just a bit of a feel of the composition of that growth in that revenue line.
The first thing I'd say, Chris, is that there's virtually none in acquired growth. You know, UMB was a reasonably small acquisition. I mean, in terms of profit, it was good for us, but it didn't add a lot of revenue to us. There's a piece of that, obviously, which is FX-driven. So about 4% of that 16% would be FX-driven. Less than 1% would be UMB and other acquisitions. And the rest would be more around price and quality of revenue than would be about number of holders, except for a few isolated markets like Hong Kong, where we've obviously added large numbers of holders. Stuart, did you want to add something to that?
I did, Chris, which is that the truth is that the commercial models in markets vary dramatically, and it's really difficult to actually work out what is activity or volume-based changes. There are some markets where you charge, there's a meter clicking for lots of different transactions. On others, the fees are much more bundled up. So the sort of breakdown you want between price changes and activity changes is actually quite difficult to split out, and I don't think we could do that with any confidence.
Probably the other thing that I didn't add, Chris, in there was that there's a full period of consolidating NRC in Russia, which when I said UMB was a very small number. NRC is, you know, slightly bigger, but it's still not a major part of that 16% growth.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Alex Chow from Credit Suisse. Go ahead, Alex.
Hi, guys. Congratulations on the very strong interim result.
Thanks, Alex, but you let me down. I tipped you to be the first question.
Oh, right. I apologise. I wasn't first on the queue. I've got two questions as well. One is, obviously, on the registry side, that we've seen very strong positive repricing experience in Australia and in the UK. I just wonder if there's further to go on that front and what experience you're getting in the US on that. And the second question is on the cost initiatives. I just wonder if you can give us a bit more detail in terms of initiatives, particularly in the US as well, on the cost front.
Alex, the repricing is, and I think I've said this on a range of occasions previously, it's not something that we see as ever being done. I think that we, just as we see the operational cost management as being a continuous process, so we see fine-tuning our commercial engagement models with our clients. You're right when you point out that we're probably furthest ahead in Australia and that the UK would come next. Canada has probably always had pretty rational pricing, and the opportunities there are not as for quantum change in the same way, but there is a very good discipline there of taking regular price increases to the client base that I think in many ways is a model for other markets. In the US, we are much earlier in the process, and it is a subject that's getting a lot of attention from our management team there. We are seeing, for instance, things like the notice and access changes providing us with new revenue lines into our client base and opportunities to grow the revenue in that way without necessarily going and saying, you know, your per holder fee goes from dollars X to 1.2 times dollars X. That said, we are in a position now in the US where I think we can really start to try and work the revenue line, and that's clearly a priority for our people there over the next period. On the operational side, we had, and I think we've been pretty transparent about this, 12 months or so ago, we had a couple of lumps operationally in the US. Those lumps are well and truly behind us. We've had a very, very solid proxy season and a very, very solid tax reporting season, and we have much better operational outcomes and client relationships as a result of that. We have, again, a range of initiatives underway to try and make sure that that's being achieved at the most practical cost. Initially, honestly, the priority was to improve the service standards rather than to take the incremental dollars out, but now we're looking to circle back and make sure that that's happening as efficiently as possible. I suspect that's more qualitative and less quantitative than you were looking for, but I hope it gives you a flavour for where we are there.
There's cost conditions as well.
Yeah, I just talked about that, I think. Yeah. I tried to.
Okay, thank you.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from David Humphreys from Morgan Stanley. Go ahead, David.
Morning, gentlemen. I've got a few questions, if I may. First one's on your outlook commentary. A bit like last year, you've been, well, I'm not sure whether you've been conservative. I think that's the question. What you've guided to is 40% growth implies a 12% shrinkage in the second half. Is that fair given the pipeline you're seeing?
I think Tom is now going to offer to replay you the answers from last year, David. Look, we take our outlook statements very seriously. We honestly, like every issuer, you'd ask the same question, would rather not be in a position where we have to become, put ourselves hostage to an uncertain future, but we recognise that that's where we are. This statement reflects our best judgement of what we will achieve for the rest of the year. Tom, do you want to...
I was just going to say, our forecasts, as you would know, David, are always appropriately conservative.
Right.
I don't think anybody would ever be in a position where they wouldn't. So I don't think we're different to any other company making an outlook statement. I'll always be on the conservative side.
We're asking business trust, though. Tom, this time you're saying, you know, we're happy to put a stake in the ground and say our second half is, on our best judgment, going to be around 12% lower than the first. That's fairly conservative.
Yeah, but it's also up a significant amount on the corresponding period last year.
Yep.
It's 27% up on the second half of last year.
Yep.
So I don't know how, you know, you can say that you think that's too conservative, but we don't believe that is.
Oh, no, but then you've got to look at where do you peg your stake for 09 then? Do you look at the second half of 08 as being more reflective or...?
And I'm sorry, David, but I've said this a number of times before. We don't give multi-year guidance.
No, that's fine. Second question's on M&A. I mean, so far you haven't been shy with the multiples you've paid. A few questions around it. I mean, do you see the current depressed pricing environment being a short-term issue? And do you need to act swiftly on the next opportunity set you see?
I'm sorry, I just missed the last little bit of that, Doug.
I guess, do you need to act swiftly on the opportunity set that you're seeing?
Oh, look, I think we... It's actually an interesting dilemma because, I mean, we do see potentially a range of opportunities emerging, and we don't want, on one hand, to have looked at everything so carefully that you end up sitting on a pile of money when you could have bought things. On the other hand, we don't want to have spent everything we could spend and have something really attractive turn up and not be able to afford that. I think that we've historically been pretty disciplined on what we reckon is fair value and been prepared to pay fair value for acquisitions. We're not in the business of trying to steal assets, but we're not in the business of overreaching on behalf of our shareholders either. And historically, we've shown ourselves to have pretty good capacity to execute quickly. We don't have laborious internal processes. We understand the businesses that we look at and try to deal with them quickly. I think that any acquisition dialogue, once you've commenced it, that there are clear advantages to executing and closing as quickly as you can, both for the purpose of your previous businesses and for the purpose of getting on with integrating the new business and minimising the uncertainty around it. I don't have a crystal ball on where market conditions are going to be and whether the opportunities that we're seeing emerge now will still be there in 6, 12, 18, 24 months' time. But it honestly doesn't matter. I mean, the opportunities, the good opportunities we'll execute on as we always have.
And I guess to my last point, on your debt arrangements, you've got a bit of headroom there as it is. I mean, is that enough for the opportunities that you see?
If every opportunity that we look at came right, no, it wouldn't be. Our people are reasonably confident that our current facilities are not the limit of what we could raise on reasonable terms.
And just on that, you've now got the best part of $1 billion in debt, and what you've suggested here is you'd be comfortable to double that. Is that pretty aggressive in this environment?
I think what I said, David, was that the board was comfortable with 2.5 to 3 times, and yes, you can do the maths and say that's pretty close to double. I think if the acquisition was right and the terms of the funding was right, then yes, we would be comfortable. But, you know, we're speaking in hypotheticals.
Okay. I'm just reflecting on what you've said versus where you're at. So.
Yeah.
And just on the covenants that your lenders look at, are they purely comfortable with the EBITDA multiple scenario, or do they also look at debt to equity?
No, they just look at that and an interest coverage.
Thanks for that.
They generally don't look at debt to equity because of the shape of our balance sheet and you know, minimum net worth type covenants around, you know, the amount of equity that we actually have, but not in a debt to equity type arrangement where a lot of our equity was issued at the equivalent of about 10 cents.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Andrew Hills from Wilson HDM. Go ahead, Andrew.
Thank you. Question for Tom or Stuart. Can you talk a little bit about the variability of the expense base which is attached to corporate actions income, please?
Yes, to the extent we can get it variable, it's variable. It's as I said in relation to earlier questions, that there's not... It's not like there's a global corporate actions factory that gets things get priced in one end and executed on off a common cost base. These are local market transactions that price in local market terms and that we pay local market costs for, but not just in corporate actions, but in a range of our businesses that have variability to them. We've worked very hard to maximise the variability of the cost base. If you want to try and quantify that, I really can't help you.
Okay, thanks. Just two other questions, just following on from David's question about lower EPS in the second half of this year compared to the first half. Can you talk a little bit about where you actually see the declines coming from half to half?
No, as I said earlier, we give outlook statements on the EPS number, not on the components that make that up.
Okay. And finally, I noticed that you've achieved your management EPS growth target. Is there going to be any revised hurdle rates?
No. What we talk about is that our hurdle at the start of each year or our target is 20% earnings growth. And so we don't revise from that. That gets reset every year. In terms of management compensation, yes, we've achieved those numbers, but we actually need to achieve them in 09 and 010, not in 08, so there's no let off on those.
Okay, thank you.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Kieran Chidgey from Merrill Lynch. Go ahead, Kieran.
Hi, guys. Two questions, if I could. The first one is firstly on costs. Overall up 5% on the prior period. However, I was just wondering if you could talk to the other direct costs, which were down 35% and a major driver of the low cost growth over the period. What was actually the reason for that and what the outlook is for that line moving forward?
I won't give a comment about the outlook of other direct costs. And the issue here, Kieran, is that other direct costs includes many different factors, and there wasn't anything by itself that drove that number. There are a number of different factors, but there wasn't any large component. And also, I mean, the other thing is that the number is very small in relation to the total cost base. So it was only $27 million out of $530 million. So if you were to look at any one of those cost lines, that's probably the one I'd spend least time, and mainly because it is so small and it includes, as I said, other type cost lines.
Okay. I agreed it is small, but if you strip out that movement, the cost growth in the remaining of the cost areas was 9%, which was obviously quite a bit higher than 5%. But that's fine. The second question is on the revenue numbers and just the admin type question. The numbers seem to have changed for the first half 07 revenue breakdown, particularly for the corporate action line. It was previously 120 mil. It was 142. I think you're saying it's 120 under today's disclosure. Just wondering what the changes have been in terms of the reallocation.
They're in various different lines, but Darren will talk to you after the call, Kieran.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Mike Younger from Citigroup. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you. And well done on another very strong result. Three questions for mine, if I may. The first was just following on from Chris's question regarding the interest rate exposure on slide 61. I was just wanting to say, does that mean that if we had the same level of balances that you've had over the past 6 months and rates in your key markets would have dropped 300 basis points, that there would not be a drop-off in margin income revenue?
No, if we have the same amount of core balances, Mike, then there wouldn't be a drop, or not a significant drop off in the margin income that we generate from those core balances. But as I said, some of those balances are not core, and so this interest rate sensitivity page on page 61 only really refers to those core balances.
You can't give us a feel for what magnitude of total balances the core represents?
Slightly less than 50%. And then in addition to that, there's another 20 to 25% which is in, there's no exposure.
Okay. Second question relates to the cost of sales line. Very, very flat result, and that ratio of cost of sales continues to fall. Would you expect for the full year and beyond that you'll be able to maintain it at around that kind of 17.5% margin?
No, Mike. The thing that drives that as much as anything is the mix of business and the drop-off in the fund services. Mutual fund proxy business in the US has a very high cost of sales ratio, what that means is that when that number falls, then so does the relative amount of cost of sales. So it's not a thing that we focus on because it's not, you know, we're not trying to drive that globally because the it's driven so much by the mix of the revenue that we're generating.
Okay. And final question relates to what you guys see as being the structural underlying margin of the business. I mean, 33% EBITDA margin is quite an extraordinary number. So I guess, where do you see the mid-cycle kind of margin on that level? And also with regards to Equiserve, we now extracted all the synergies out of Equiserve.
Look, the truth is, I think, that we have a portfolio of businesses that the average, over this 6-month period, the average margin, as you said, was 32-odd%. The truth is that some of them are sub 20 and some of them are going on 50. So the underlying margin is not just a question of cycles, it's a question of cycles in different geographies, it's a question of cycles across different business lines. There is not a single global cycle that drives our business. There are a range of different cycles, and so to talk about an underlying mid-cycle margin is just impossible and not helpful. In terms of Equiserve synergies, we have, I think, extracted all the benefits financially that come simply from putting two businesses together and getting rid of the redundant bits of technology, of premises, of people. That doesn't mean that there isn't significant room for improved financial performance in our US transfer agency business, as there is in all our businesses globally. Of course there is, and we'll continue to look for efficiencies on the cost side and improvements on the revenue side, but I think we've reached the point where we wouldn't say that they are attributable to the fact of the merger. They're just attributable to how you run your business.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, the next question comes from Ivor Rees from Balio. Go ahead, Ivor.
Yes, two questions, probably for Tom, I guess. Just on the fund balances, Tom, of $8.7 billion, based on the work that you have on your books at the moment, would you expect that balance to be higher or lower at the end of your financial year? And if I may just throw the other questions in here at this stage, in two of your registry businesses, Canada and the UK, you've seen quite a big rise in your register maintenance revenue. I just want to know whether they're due to one-off factors or whether they're sustainable increases in revenue on those businesses.
So your second question first, Ivor, and there's not too much one-off type work in the registry maintenance numbers. The UK is having the impact of some pricing adjustments that have taken place over there the last couple of years since Chris has been there, and also Standard Life, which was a very large increase there. And Canada, as much as anything, is due to price adjustments there, and also somewhat related to your last question is getting the balances for longer and therefore generating some more margin income into that registry maintenance line, because we have the dividends for longer and other types of things in the Canadian business. So both of those things are there. I really wouldn't like to project the balance, Ivor. There's too many factors at play, and remember remember it's an average of an average.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, but you would imagine dividend payouts are going to be higher. We're getting more balances for longer periods of time. There are some very large corporate actions, cash corporate actions that we know about in the next 6 months. But then again, there was in the last 6 months. So I really would prefer not to answer that question because there's too many factors at play.
Okay. And just the if I go back to my other question about the growth in register maintenance, you've had some price increases in that half. Do you have any more price increases coming around globally?
Stuart already answered that question in that he said that it's not just about price increases, and I probably emphasised that a little bit too much. It's also delivering additional services to the clients. And he also said that it's an ongoing press to continue to charge the full worth for our services.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, the final question comes from Ryan Fisher from Goldman Sachs. Go ahead, Ryan.
Thank you. Guys, I just wanted to go back to the question, probably four or five questions ago, that Andrew asked, and I know that you have already answered it, so I'm risking you telling me that you've already answered it. But the thing is, it's absolutely critical to the stock because I don't think anybody's naive enough to think that corporate actions is one of your lower EBIT margin businesses. I think it's pretty clear that it's, you know, maybe above average. We just don't know how much above average. But equally, there's a lot of people out there that try and create the impression that that the corporate actions revenue is straight profit, which is also clearly not correct. I'm just wondering if you can give us some idea as to, you know, how much cost comes, you know, qualitatively, how much cost comes with corporate actions.
Ryan, for the last 5 years, what we've said is that corporate actions are a higher profit margin than the rest of our business, and we would still that would still hold true even with the rest of our business making a higher margin. Corporate actions tend to be higher, but I wouldn't like to say any more than that.
Can I just maybe just ask a very direct question then to say, can we assume that it's considerably less than 100% sort of variability to that revenue line, which I think is what some would perceive?
It's funny, Ryan, you say that, because I haven't heard that from anyone, that 100% of corporate actions flows into the bottom line, and it's obviously much less than that. We obviously need to do a considerable amount of work for almost all the corporate actions that we undertake.
Okay, I think I'll just cut my losses there.
The reason we can't answer it is that it just varies so dramatically from market to market and from shape of transaction to shape of transaction. It is worth pointing out, and it probably doesn't help allay your concerns, that just as we worked on business as usual pricing on the registry maintenance side, we've also worked on the revenue line on corporate actions, and some of the growth in that number is not just because of transaction volumes, it's because we're getting better commercial recognition for the frankly very significant risks we take in processing these huge, complex and time-critical transactions.
Mm. Thanks for that, Stuart. I mean, I'm not actually concerned. My belief is it's not that extreme, but it's just that the free kick for anybody that wants to sort of discredit the hard work and structural improvement that you guys put through the business, the easy approach is say, well, you know, corporate actions revenue comes in while you sleep and it'll go out while you sleep. So I was just trying to get a feel for, what a more realistic leverage factor is, but we'll have to work that through ourselves.
Yeah, I'm afraid you will. But thank you for the thought. I appreciate it.
Okay, that's the final call. I'd like to thank you all for participating today, and we'll speak again in August. Thanks very much. Bye.